Hadi bakalım.
Democrats are trying to figure out how to make Trump to be a fascist for creating peace in the Middle East.
Not bad. I'm trying to figure out how that works.
Well, especially after the debate I got into with that protester at the Vivek Ramaswamy event that we went to.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah,
we went to a Turning Point USA event here in Bozeman at MSU's campus earlier in the week, and Vivek was there. And walking in, there was only one protester. Walking out, there were like maybe two dozen or something like that, right? And and we were just like, hey, should we get in a conversation? And so David jumped in and we filmed it, and maybe we'll publish a clip from it.
We should later this week. We should publish the thing. It'd be fun. It was a good conversation. What we discovered was that fascism pretty much means things I don't like that have to do with America, or something like that, right? It was like people liking America. I don't know. It was
if
very
you
strange.
Like America too much and you want to use the government for things, you're a fascist.
Yeah, exactly.
1776 will commence again.
Yes, but anyways, we're going to be diving into on the anniversary. A couple days after the anniversary of October 7th, the terrible massacre by Hamas and other Palestinians of Israelis 2 years ago. We're going to be going over kind of the developments since then, and we kind of had planned to do that. And I was actually planning on doing like, we actually discovered a lot about what happened that day that we didn't know and hasn't really bubbled up to the mainstream. Like, for example, there's three waves of different excursions that actually happen on that day, that there were lots of people who weren't Hamas who also left Gaza on that day and were, you know, part of the entire thing. And it was really interesting, and we're not going to get into that this time because other developments have overtaken that review. But the Max Blumenthal did a really interesting interview on the Provoked podcast with Daryl Cooper and Scott Horton on the anniversary. That was really, really great and worth checking out. Because there was a lot that was said that has really turned out to either be like not quite right or completely not true or just never really gotten to the mainstream of American press.
Wish I could say I was surprised by that, but I'm just not.
Yeah, you know? That's just how it goes.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Yeah, but we have a peace deal now, apparently, right? Hamas has accepted the peace deal, so we're excited to get into that.
You're full of shit today.
We'll see how long it lasts. I mean, I don't know. It's a terrible thing to be cynical about.
Yeah.
But at this point, we've gone back and forth a few times, and it's going to be interesting to see how long it lasts.
Yeah.
Before we get into everything, I want to welcome you back to Human Reaction. We're glad to have you. Of course, for those of you that have been around a long time, you know this is your source for independent commentary on news, culture, politics, etc. And today we're going to be breaking down the Israel issue. If you're new here, please do subscribe to the channel. I learned this the other week. Only 6% of our viewers are actually subscribed. So
whoa.
Those of you in the 94%, please hit the subscribe button, like the video, leave us a comment, let us know what you think. Do you think this Israel peace deal is going to last? And without further ado, let's get into it.
Yeah. I want to start out by making a case for all ceasefires always. Right, because it's easy to be cynical.
How dare you!
But what it does is it underways just how terrible war is, just how awful what's happening in Gaza has been, and how awful all war is always. And if you look at, for example, I wore my anti-war shirt today with Smedley Butler.
War is a racket.
War is a racket. As a bit of a symbol of like the American perspective and the creation of the American empire that he was, that, you know, him and many other veterans and people who've dealt with war directly have said, have demonstrated, have so eloquently put that when you have a chance, any chance to stop it, do it. Yeah. Almost always. It's cliche. You say, give peace a chance, right? And you say that, and it sounds like I'm a hippie, and I got like a guitar, and I'm singing to Marilyn Manson or something. I don't know. There's some weird... You know, like that's how that movement ended, right?
I could have picked a lot of artists before Marilyn Manson.
but you're with the Beach Boys, you know, in the mansion. I've been doing a lot of things on that. Anyway, so the point I'm trying to make is that it's cliche, but it is the moral standard. It should be everyone's moral standard that first and foremost, whatever stops the killing is the right thing to do. And so, you know, you can. There's lots of reasons to be pessimistic by how the deal shook out for the Palestinians' sake, or if you're Israelis. There's lots of reasons to be upset, but that probably means it's a decent deal, you know, for both sides. And there's lots of reasons to be skeptical because the last one fell apart, the one that was forged, I think, in December, right? It was actually before Trump came to office, or early January, I can't remember which. And how that one fell apart immediately, never got to phase two.
Yeah.
It's understandable for that, but this is the platform in which something good can happen, right? And that's just nothing good was happening, and now something potentially maybe could happen.
Right. So there's a reason to be hopeful that this one will work out.
Yeah, or at least it's the moral position is to have hope in that moment, because that's the only way to do it. So anyways, what happened? So this week, Trump announced that both Israel and Hamas had signed his 20-point peace plan that he had introduced earlier this year, about around September 29th.
So do you think he got up in front of everyone in a boardroom with like a PowerPoint? Was like, I'd like to walk you through my 20-point peace plan. Next slide, please.
Imagine it was Steve Witkoff or something like that. But this was done in collaboration with Egypt and Qatar. As well, you know, our sponsors, Qatar.
Right.
Yes.
Excellent pronunciation.
Yeah. I'm working on it.
The money means a lot to you because you're pronouncing it perfectly.
Qatar.
Oh my God. Ew, David.
Just a little bit of Arabic and Bennett's all offended.
It's more that he sounded like Ben Shapiro.
Okay. So they got to the table, 20-point peace plan, probably Steve Witkoff, envoy there to do the negotiating. Mm-hmm. What happened next?
As well as other people. Jared Kushner's been involved since the beginning, and there's been other folks around there. There's a lot of conspiracy theorizing around what this all means about, like, who exactly is all involved. Not touching that for now, but talking mostly about that, you know, there was like an initial agreement on what was really the scope of the plan, right? So the core of it is Israel gets the release of the rest of the remaining hostages, about 20 remaining living hostages, and 28 deceased within 72 hours of the ceasefire, which went into place at 6 o'clock today, that time. So I don't know what time that is here, but it should be in now. There were attacks going right up to that ceasefire time point from Israel, which is kind of, as if I understand it right, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm reading that is kind of like what they do.
Clearly. I mean, they've done that before when there have been presumed ceasefires happening where 20 minutes ahead of time, there's a missile landing in Gaza somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. They get to retain about 53% of Gaza.
Israel does.
Yes.
Okay.
Temporary full ceasefire starting 24 hours after the approval.
Right. Okay.
So what Hamas got out of it was a release of about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners, including 250 profile lifters, like the high profile people, all women and children post October 7th detainees. So if they were detained after October 7th last year and they're a woman and a child, they get released, as well as 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. Now, important to understand the scale. We're talking Israeli prisons have tens of thousands. If I've read someplace, close to 100,000 is Palestinian prisoners.
Really?
Yeah. So they have huge prison population, many of which are like political prisoners, some of which are actually like violent criminals and understandably should be incarcerated.
Right? Sure.
They also get this yellow line movement. So with this partial withdrawal of Israel to what they call the yellow line, which is like a map that's part of the plan, they get moved back there. And then with additional security, like milestones reached, Israel should pull back more. That's the idea.
I see. So they're keeping 53% for now until things are stabilized, and then they're going to slowly recede to a different border or the existing border?
Yeah, that's a friendlier way to think about it. So the real criticism of the deal from the pro-Palestine people is that so once Hamas releases all the remaining hostages, Israel's bombing is suspended, but it's not like guaranteed to end. It's really up to Trump to enforce the deal at that point because Hamas has lost all their leverage, right?
Right.
There's no disincentive per se in the deal. Nothing automatically happens. The deal does say that that Israel can't occupy or annex Gaza, but that's like in name of sorts. But withdrawal is conditional on these like standards and milestones and timeframes. That's linked to demilitarization. But the entire contention from Hamas' side, the one thing they wouldn't give up is to be disarmed.
That makes sense.
From the American ear, it totally makes sense.
Yeah, of
right?
course.
You're like, of course they wouldn't do that, right? Because that would mean they have no ability to fight back if
right.
Israel reneged on the deal.
They would get steamrolled at some point, for sure.
Yeah. So there's the governance question is a big part of that too, right? So they have to meet part of those milestones is like the governance. Like does the Palestinian people, do they like accept some governing international stabilization source or ISF, right?
So that would be some government, not Hamas.
Yes. And that was one of the an interesting part of this, right? Because Israel's war aim was to kill Hamas, like destroy Hamas. But they're not really getting that. They're getting Hamas saying, well, we won't run Gaza anymore. But they've been saying that since 2024.
Sure.
So Hamas isn't going anywhere. They're just going to join other groups. There's many other political groups they could join. So that their Hamas persists. They're just going to no longer be called that or no longer rule Gaza. But you'll have this new international stabilization force that will then run the Gaza Strip.
Gotcha. Who is at the head of that international stabilizing force?
I've heard Tony Blair. I've heard that like that's, but I don't know if that's like decided yet or anything that's really there.
I mean,
and I imagine a lot of this stuff will have to be negotiated, right? Because it makes sense, especially from the Arab world, to put an Arab in charge of it.
You would think.
Yeah.
Someone who will be more amicable perhaps to the needs of the Palestinian people in their own country.
Right.
So is this... It is the international stabilizing force, is that any sort of acknowledgement of a Palestinian state at all, or is this still just no man's land with some people in it?
Yeah, I don't see that. Like there's no real guarantee of a Palestinian state in the bid deal that I was able to find or really understand. What they're trying to say is that they're going to disarm them, and then they're going to provide full aid, and then they're going to put in this group, and the Palestinians kind of go along with it. It seems. To the degree that they're signed onto the deal, but there's still a lot that you have to be negotiated, right?
Right.
So both sides, you know, didn't get some parts of what they wanted.
I imagine that the Palestinian people kind of have to at this point. Like,
right.
Their entire lives have been completely upended since October 7th. Mm-hmm. I mean, and, you know, to whatever degree, some sort of retaliation was warranted to take out the hostile forces that were threatening to Israel. You know, granted that the innocent civilians there have had their lives completely turned upside down.
Yes.
And they don't have any other means of getting aid because they're blocking the aid from coming in, right? So
yeah, and
they're sort of in a bad bargaining position.
Well,
they have to take
part of the deal is the end. What? Part of the deal is the end of the current provider, which is like this NGO that's actually Israeli run and that is the relief aid organization that provides the aid. That has been so controversial this whole time.
And did we do an episode on that?
Did
I listen to an episode?
Yeah, we did. We did an episode on that.
They all start to run together at a certain point. Yeah. You forget what you talked about and what you've ingested from the internet.
Right. And we've talked about, you know, like almost like 80% of the buildings knocked over, like 70%, and then like almost all the roads and almost all the infrastructure is knocked out. So like the total destruction of Gaza, that's a real thing.
Yeah.
And you're right, you know, the lack of access to food and drinkable water, the practices around this aid delivery program has been something that is, you know, really devastated the Palestinian community. I don't know how else you say that, right? You can say that, and then if you're an Israeli person, say, but it was worth it to get Hamas out. But the challenge is that didn't really happen.
Well, right. Like, and it raises the question, like, did Israel actually accomplish the goal that they set out for?
It's not really clear that they did. I mean, at the end of the day, it was really always in their camp to be able to decide when peace would happen. They said they wouldn't exchange. They would never do an exchange for Palestinian prisoners for Israeli prisoners. They ended up doing that. They could have done that forever ago, like back in January, but they're not. Now they're doing it. Yeah, at least to ask you why Israel decided to end phase one in the first place. You just don't. My conspiratorial brain starts to go off. You know, you start thinking like, well, they hadn't got to a Tacaron yet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was that really why they didn't want to get to a peace process? Because it would have been a lot tougher then, you know?
But I mean, even the attacks on Iran didn't really accomplish much. I mean,
by Bibi's point of view, as of this week, he's already coming out saying, "Yeah, they're going to have intercontinental ballistic missiles now."
Yeah, that could reach the U.S. again. Yeah. The old talking points are getting trotted out again, and I know there's been conflicting reports around how much damage is actually done in Iran. So, I mean, it's a big question. I guess another question I have around this is like, okay, so with this peace deal in place to this point, who are the winners and the losers in this whole equation?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, Israel is getting a lot of what they want in the terms of Hamas will no longer run Gaza. Now, remember that Hamas ran Gaza in part because Israel supported them to run Gaza.
Right. That was the Likud party's position, right? Or Bibi's direct position that was published in newspapers in Israel, was
it
not?
Yeah, that they had been funding them.
Right.
Through which country?
Qatar. We're gonna get in trouble for that. I'm saying it right, but it feels wrong. You know what I mean?
No, it's like the average white liberal that for some reason decides to pronounce Spanish words with a perfect accent. You know, there's only one word. My Latino friends.
You're right. That's why it sounds weird. Why it sounds weird. You got it. Okay, so what Israel didn't get, right, was really the full disarmament. Like, that is probably never going to happen, right? I think everyone's just saying accepting that, although it's still technically part of the negotiation. And there's no like total victory here. There's no end solution for the Palestinian problem here, if that's indeed what they were going for. And some of the right-wing faction was saying they're going to. Now, was that ever realistic? Probably not. Without an actual ethnic cleansing, which is what they've been accused that they were trying to do, and therefore they couldn't do. Because the eyes of the world were on that,
right?
You know, so like it's definitely in the environment, in the context of the entire world really turning against Israel in this media war that they've been in, and the inability of Israel to defend their position, because it's a really hard position to defend.
It really is. Everything about it does not look good for what Israel has been doing, and the entire world, basically, with the exception of a component of the American right, it seems, and you know, Zionists in the United States and obviously Israelis are on the other side of this issue, it seems like, especially according to, you know, what happened at the UN when all of the ambassadors walked out on Bibi's speech. It raises the question for me, what state does this find Bibi in? Because before October 7th, he was in some hot water, mm-hmm. right? Is he going to return to that sort of political risk, or, you know, even worse now that there's not a conflict for him to sort of be distracting people with?
Yeah, I mean, it's worse than a distraction. I mean, there was a point, I think we reported on this, when the Iran strikes were happening in Tel Aviv, where even the opposition leader who was trying to prosecute Bibi said, "We're not talking about that now. It doesn't matter. We have to buckle down. We're rallying around the flag because we're at war."
Yeah.
I mean, and keep in mind that, you know, Israel's been at war, you know, with five other countries as they're prosecuting this whole thing in Gaza, which isn't really a country. It's really, you know, it's like an Indian reservation. So, you know, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and Qatar, right? Are there a war at Qatar? I don't know. It's but they did strike Qatar, and that was one of the things that kind of derailed the entire negotiation process in the summertime. And this, and really kind of visualized Trump's 20-point plan as a reset. It's not substantially different from what was before. I mean, it was a little bit different, but not that much different by my eyes. I'm not an expert in this area, but just looking at it from the outside, that it doesn't seem that much different, but it is something that kind of reset the tone and allowed them to get back to the table and negotiate after Trump apparently, and this was just reported, apparently had Bibi read a apology letter to Qatar's leadership.
Yeah. I read about that, and this is also a component of an interesting seeming shift in the power dynamics, at least the public perception of the power dynamics mm-hmm. between Trump and Bibi. It has seemed up until maybe the last week or 10 days that Bibi's wearing the pants in this relationship mm-hmm. in the way that they're handling things at press conferences and the way that basically Israel's getting everything that they want and the U.S. is just doing their bidding with attacking Iran and this and that. And Trump will maybe bluster a little bit here and there and say, oh, you know what, you know, we're not gonna let them do that, but they've just gone ahead and done that every time.
Yeah.
Until this last week, when all of a sudden it seems like Trump got really ticked off at Bibi, and there was some heated exchanges that made their way through the news cycle. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a like a substantial real shift in the power dynamic, or is it just sort of media play?
Or yeah, kayfabe, right? Right. That's a good question. I do think Trump is a person who really has his thumb on public sentiment. And he won in part because young people voted for him. Young men voted for him overwhelmingly, which is very strange for any Republican. That is a generational opportunity. And you could definitely tell a story where Trump is seeing those tea leaves and thinking, my legacy, the ability for the next MAGA person to be MAGA and win the Republican ticket, to advance my agenda that I've been trying to do to reset the American economy, the American's position in the world, the whole orientation of DC and the swamp. If that's really what he's about, is on the line about whether or not is suddenly no longer on the line of the trade war. Like that's actually a third or fourth tier issue.
Yes.
No matter, that was really big that first time around, remember?
Yeah.
Now it's Israel-Gaza, and that's where he's losing the youth and where things are just going to get worse if he persists. So did he run out of patience? Was the Doha attack like the straw that broke the camel's back? I mean, that's like really, you can violate a negotiation once, you know, one time.
Right.
But if you do it twice, how many times are people ever going to trust you again? Right.
Yeah. And so remember George Bush's famous quote, fool me once.
Just stalls out.
I won't get fooled again.
Yeah, right.
You can't get fooled again.
Wise words.
Oh, man,
wise
that
words.
Was president once. You forget.
You do.
You forget the Bushisms. Yeah. See, so, I mean, like, yeah, he did that in Iran where he's like, invite him to
strategery.
Yeah.
There it is.
There it is.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that's Will Ferrell as George Bush, but well,
totally works.
He said that. I'm pretty sure.
Now watch this drive.
I forgot it.
Sorry.
Where was I at?
Was the attack in Doha sort of a line in the sand?
Yeah, for Trump? And then like depends on how much you believe this reporting that he made Netanyahu actually apologize. Right. That's a good question. I don't know that's true. I don't have the primary sourcing there, so I don't know. But that's been reported. So
I'm just picturing Bibi sitting there like a scolded 5-year-old who like socked his friend in the mouth, and his parents make him go over and knock on the door and like say sorry. Like, doesn't really comport with the view that I have of Bibi as a leader or a person that happened. But
you could say it.
I don't know.
You know, you could be like, he's on the phone. He's got his, you know, piece of paper out. He's like, I think you are a really great person and yes. I want to be friends.
I'm really sorry that I blew up your building. I won't do it again.
And then people probably at the time were really questioning whether or not I had American permission because Americans control all that airspace. It's right next to the largest base in the Middle East we have.
Yeah.
So, of course, Americans said yes or refused to enforce or something like that. It would have been a huge international incident if they had, you know, shot down an Israeli plane. But scramble jets, prevent them from coming by, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, you don't know. Anyways, this whole thing is coming together in a very peculiar environment where they have a lot left to negotiate. This isn't like the same kind of phase plan. This is a commitment to ceasefire, unending. So it is different than the first round of plans. And I think that there's a, you know, the opportunity of the, you know, there's a conditional acceptance that still needs to be negotiated. A lot of details still have to be worked out, but it could still be the place. That said, not everyone in Israel wants it to work.
Who doesn't want it to work?
Ben Gavir. So he is he's the Israeli national security minister.
Is he like their John Bolton or something?
Yeah, something like that. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And so he's, and in more ways than ones, like he's also a psychopath.
Does he have a glorious mustache as well?
I'm not aware of his mustache. No mustache status not checked. You better go and get on Google Images right now. Find out that guy's mustache.
Ben, why don't you check the mustache status of Ben Gavir?
What's his name?
Ben Gavir.
Yeah, Ben-Gavir. So he led approximately 1,300 Israeli settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque yesterday.
Oh, no.
So get this. So like conditional acceptance, October 3rd. October 3rd. That's when like the deadline set by Trump. October 4th. It is accepted by October 8th, it's accepted by Hamas and Israel. that same day, the national security, you know, minister, during an Israeli holiday, like a official holiday, storms a mosque that is specifically on, it's on the Temple Mount, but it's specifically internationally recognized as a Muslim site. That's an old deal going way back to try to generate peace, and does a bunch of shenanigans to, you know, provoke.
Wow. Yeah. So this is some, like, trying to bring the prophecy about stuff that seems to be happening
here. It's that, and it's also like, it's like politics, right? This is like Antifa showing up at the Tea Party rally. Well, and this
is the crazier thing is it like a government official like rallied a militia?
Yeah,
just extra, you know, governmentally and just waltzed in there and started causing problems. Like what did they do?
I didn't read anything about violence, but it was like it was a, you know, pissing contest functionally going up there to generate this. Now, if you've ever read Fear and Loathing in the New Jerusalem, read it, listen to it. And that's the work of Martyr Maid. I'm kind of charting out the
what?
Not quite. Look at the second image I just put in there.
Hey Bennett, why don't you run that through Grok and have him put John Bolton's mustache on it?
Oh my god,
it's the same guy. Dude, I'm telling you. I was like, it's the fat guy from Jurassic Park.
It's the it's the office meme of like,
see, no one cares. You could just go up to the mosque. No one cares.
And he gets up there and he's like, Jerry.
Jesus. Oh, man, it's so fucked.
Wow.
Oh, man. So, okay, guess how many times this dude has done this?
12.
This is Three. The 11th time.
Oh, my God.
Good guess. Good guess. The 11th time he's done this.
Such a good guesser.
The last time was right before October 7th.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's long been speculated that one of the provocations beyond the Abrahamic Accords and beyond kind of getting forgotten about by the rest of the rest of the Middle East, beyond the disruption of the Shia Crescent and all that strategic questions about
strategery
around the movement of weapons, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was considered one of the, you know, inciting incidents.
Interesting.
And if you look back at the kind of escalatory violence that really kicked things off at the very in the origins, it was often around this sort of thing, right? And that's why I mentioned like Martyr Maid and like Fear and Loathing in New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It's often like a very low level conflict that happens just between some teenagers or between some teenagers, some old people or whatever, that just steps up and steps up and steps up. Before you know it, you're in a full blown civil war. Yeah.
Fascinating. Not entirely different from the circumstances we find ourselves in here these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Which we'll get into in another video today.
Indeed.
So, that's what's going on. I do want to know too, I mean, given that where we're at and mentioning all the devastation, we're still sitting at 67,000 Palestinians killed, 169,000 wounded. That's about 11% of the total population, which is pretty wild when you think about it.
And where is that 67,000 number coming from?
That's almost all internal Hamas reporting, like I mean Hamas, but you know, news outlets connected to Palestinian organizations. It's almost always tied in with their governments, just like every news media organization in the world.
Yeah,
who historically have been pretty accurate, haven't they?
Yeah, there's everyone who makes errors.
Yeah,
I just struggle. I don't know who to believe.
Yeah.
Right. I want to believe that anytime an Israeli person is saying in good faith until I can prove them otherwise.
Right.
And I've yet to see any good debunking of these numbers beyond, well, that's coming from, you know, Al Jazeera, so therefore don't believe it. It's like, I can't play that game. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm operating on the best numbers I can find according to multiple resources.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm sure it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
What both sides report.
Yeah. I mean, and even then, like, yeah. And so, and then lastly, we're looking at $21 billion of aid that America sent it, approximately $10 billion more in direct operations against Iran and Yemen since 2023.
Wow.
So, $31 billion on this.
That's insane.
Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully this peace still can last. Hopefully we can see something coming out of it that's real.
Yeah.
I mean, but I like I said, I don't see why now is different than phase two, other than like unless Israel has really been exhausted by this whole process, by being bombed themselves by Tehran, by just the sheer pressure of the international world. I don't know if that really matters in Israel or not.
Well, I mean,
it's hard to say.
You have to think, like, at a certain point, there's some self-reflection maybe that needs to go on in a governmental or national level around the war that they've been prosecuting mm-hmm. against the Palestinians. Like, the only political constituency that they have really been able to rely on in the sort of modern America First era is this component of the Republican Party that is very pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. And that is dwindling because it's primarily an older population that, you know, has had a lot of these feelings instilled in them for many decades. And the young people, as we mentioned, and as we saw at the Turning Point event, the first couple questions that came up when people got in line to do the customary Q&A mm-hmm. were directed towards the conflict with Israel. And Vivek, mm-hmm. very politically, not to my liking, unfortunately, but like kind of just sidestepped the question. Granted, it was October 7th, and that would have looked very bad, as you pointed out. But there's no getting around the fact that the tides have turned with regard to American sentiment, particularly young American sentiment towards Israel. And you have to think that has to come into the calculus at some point mm-hmm. because they can't expect to continue doing what they're doing, have these kids grow up into a large voting bloc that is eventually going to have some sort of influence in Washington and vote people in that are going to change the way that America provides aid to Israel, which seems like they really, in some senses, rely on and in some senses really enjoy. I mean, I understand they get free healthcare, they get free college, they get a lot of free things and a lot of money from the U.S. to pay for them. And meanwhile, our economy is, well, according to Trump, great, but, you know, inflation is up. People are paying way more for, you know, groceries and energy.
Unemployment's rising.
Unemployment is rising and our infrastructure is failing and we have all these problems. We have, you know, our own immigration situation to deal with. It's going to be very costly. And so it's like, you can see why people would be frustrated by this and you can see why they would want to change the relationship with our supposedly best ally.
Yes.
It all makes sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree what you're saying. And it's a question, like, we've been debating this for 2 years now. Like, it's been really exhausted on the right. And it does not look like the pro-Israel forces have won. You know, at the end of the day, I don't see them gaining traction at this point, amongst online at least. The cable news crowd, they don't really have debates. They have, you know, distilled talking points. So I don't really see where they're winning in any front beyond maybe the purchase of TikTok.
And that seems to be a factor.
To kind of filter that narrative out of there. But even then, it's kind of too little too late maybe. I think that horse is kind of out of the stables, you know?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the fact that it came out almost immediately that organizations tied to pro-Israel movements in the United States were paying influencers to make posts that were favorable to Israel.
Well, no, that
$7,000 per post.
It wasn't even leaked. He got up in front of the cameras and said, we're going to do this.
It was just trotted out there. We're going to start paying people to speak well of Israel. It's like, okay, that might have worked in an era where the only news that you had was Walter Cronkite, but it doesn't work when you have podcasts and you have alternative media and social media, like all this stuff happening. Like the word spreads way too quickly.
Mm-hmm. And everyone is paid. Like that's how media works, right? Everyone has advertisers, everyone has a thing. You know, but accepting it from a foreign government and talking about something this sensitive, it's such a bad look, dude.
Dude, it's beyond a bad look. It's like, it's shameful to me. Mm. It's like, how dumb do you think we are?
Yeah. You know? However, it was such a
Qatar,
bad play.
If they want to throw some money out, right?
Hey, we're still open. Give me a call. Qatar. But you know what I mean? Like, it's the pro-Israel post, and then the first reply is a $7,000 check. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
It is so memeified. It's such a... It was destructive of their own ends. I just don't see how it's really moving the ball anywhere.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so, I mean, yeah, at very least, I could see the strategy being on BB's side of things. Like, we got to just let this simmer for a bit, get out of the primary headlines, mm-hmm. let this quiet down and then hope people forget about it. But of course, like, we won't.
Yeah.
Like, it's, well, we're not
gonna, and that circles on what you think, what's going to happen to BB, right? Because, like, you know, we had this rally around the flag. Once all these things go down, if he can't generate another war with Iran,
I was going to ask,
you know,
that.
Does the prosecution continue? Yeah. If he's smart, maybe he resigns and the prosecution goes away, because that's like kind of like the classy political thing to do.
Is he going to resign and just come here? Because didn't he like grow up in America? I feel like that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I've never done a deep dive on his background, but I have read that he went to high school in like Pennsylvania or something.
He's got a house in Martha's Vineyard next to the Obamas. He'll probably just, you know, hang out, get paid a lot of money to go talk to think tanks and mm-hmm. smoke cigars with John Bolton.
Yeah.
Reminisce about the good old days.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that.
I hope not.
Yep. So I have a lot of hope for this, if only because we have another strong signal that it could work, that Trump is committed to making this work. And that's because he probably wants to start a new war in Venezuela. Just think about it. Just hold with me here. Now, when the Venezuela thing happened, I predicted, well, maybe Ukraine is actually going to wind down because we can't do that many wars at once. Right? That's just not wise. At some point, you know,
we got to call it quits. Stopped us before.
Hold my beer.
But I mean, really, I mean, come on. I mean, like we're deploying, you know, a bunch of carrier group and a bunch of battleships, and as of like this week, we deployed more F-35s, which aren't exactly helpful in drug trafficking. You know, so like to the Caribbean
or in the rain. It is very damp in the tropics.
Yeah. Remember that one, or with pilots? Remember that guy ejected out on accident and it flew off? Like,
ghost ride the whip.
Man, that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Jesus.
Yeah, geez. So therefore, I mean, I think that's one of our best cases for this actually working, that like Trump wants something to work. He wants the win, so he's going to get this win so he can move on to new wins. And that will be probably a regime change war in Venezuela is what it's shaping up to be, which is not an encouraging thing for the America First crowd. If you're a conservative and you voted for this guy because you didn't want nuclear war with Russia, because you wanted a strategic pivot to actual, you know, global hegemons that are appearing on the horizon, like China, if you're the more hawkish end of MAGA, right? Or if you're more on the non-interventionist side and you were like, I want less wars. And it looks like, you know, Kamala Harris is an empty vessel for the war machine.
Mm-hmm.
At least this guy might have ideas, you know, so fits that guy. Unfortunately, it looks like it's not going that way for this, right? As of this week, Trump has called off efforts to reach a diplomatic agreement with Venezuela altogether. Now, the context of that is, so late August, warships were deployed to southern Caribbean near Venezuela as part of the broader naval buildup in the area. In September, and you could probably have seen the videos, we sunk a ship, did it again a couple weeks later.
Wasn't it like a military ship? It was like a drug boat, allegedly, right?
Yeah, allegedly. Yeah. It was a speedboat.
Right.
It wasn't like a carrier.
No.
Like thing. And another strike, you know, October, right? October 6th. Maduro claimed that the Venezuelan security forces foiled a right-wing extremist plan to bomb a shuttered embassy in Caracas and blame his government. So he thinks, like Maduro claims, that there was a false flag attack using radical right-wing extremist forces, whatever that means, to a socialist government. I mean, I don't know. That goes, they could have
moderates.
Been. I don't know what their philosophy could have been, but right. He claims they're a radical right. It would definitely be within the profile of American security spy craft to mm-hmm. use extremist elements to do that sort of thing.
Yep.
Yeah. So he claims that October 6th, right? So that's only 3 days ago. And October 7th, reports confirmed that there is intensified U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean near Venezuela, deploying F-35B fighter jets to Puerto Rico, the USS Lake Erie cruiser, and special operations vessel MV Ocean Trader positioned near Trinidad and Tobago?
Mm-hmm.
Tobago, yeah. And that's only 80 miles from Venezuela. That's relatively close. So we have this big buildup happening right next door. We're bombing ships. The bombing of the ships appears to me to be completely against the law.
It's very extrajudicial.
Well, there's no statutory authority. Like, you don't have to have a judicial process for quite a few things for the executive, right?
Sure.
Act of war, war's declared, an authorizing authority of some kind. But, okay, and even like counter-narcotics. Like, I actually looked this up. So I'm not a professional podcaster, so I don't have time to research everything. But I did get really interested in the question of what is the actual statutory authority to stop narcotics into the United States? In like the naval vessel area where you're talking about is interdiction, stopping them and boarding them to look for drugs. That's all there is interdiction, right? It's how you stop and search. It doesn't say anything about just blowing them up.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So the argument appears to me, and I'm trying to steel man the administration's argument here, is that, well, we declared TDA, Tren de Agua, a terrorist organization, And so therefore we can do this. But none of the terror authorizations used in military force say any terrorist organization. It's Al-Qaeda and its connected groups, right? Al-Qaeda and the people around Al-Qaeda. Is there any evidence from the federal government that Tren de Agua is collaborating with Al-Qaeda?
That's a great question.
I mean, did they meet the Syrian prime minister at some point and like plan something? That's what I want to know.
It's classified.
Is that a thing? Maybe, maybe at the UN? Is that what happened?
They shook hands once.
I mean, I don't see any real justification there. Now, the next closest thing that I looked at was Obama's drone war program. So that program was all justified under the authorization use of military force from 2001 or 2002, which was Iraq. And I actually got this. This is an interesting quote. This is from Obama's legal advisor, Harold Koh. Quote, the president may use lethal force abroad against non-state actors if those actors pose a continuing and imminent threat to U.S. persons and local governments are unwilling or unable to act. That is his justification for the drone warfare program. Now, overall, most of the drone warfare program was actually done with the local governments, the governments that they're talking about in the Middle East, with their collaboration, right? Mm-hmm. Pakistan or in Syria or in, Yemen. And we were actually collaborating with the Houthis to identify Al-Qaeda targets back then before we went to war with them. So this is even weaker because even that was still justified tenably around the 2001 AOMF. So there's like, I don't see any at all legal justification here. And it looks to me that the whole thing is just being sold. Well, they had drugs on board. But there's no evidence that they
had drugs. Yeah, we don't know that.
Yeah.
We have no evidence of that. It's at the bottom of the ocean now.
Yeah, one of the vessels had like, it was
a speeder
with eight people on it. Where are the drugs? You know, it's not. Well, I mean, there's a lot of people on a relatively small boat.
I mean, there's room. There'd be room for eight people and drugs on a boat, no problem.
On a small boat?
Well, it's like a cigarette boat, right? They've got a really like long hole, essentially, in a like cargo space underneath.
Yeah,
from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but like, are we talking about like real drug movements here? Like, I mean, and what is the evidentiary basis of that?
I mean, these are great questions. And yeah, definitely things that I feel like the administration is accountable to answering definitively to justify this.
And think of it, if you're running drugs, why would you put eight people on board? It's a lot of people to feed and do all the water and all that kind of stuff to move cargo around. Like, it doesn't, I don't know. There could be a lot of reasons to take a boat out into the Caribbean.
I read something recently, and let me know if you've corroborated this anywhere, but I read recently that it actually came out that I think the second boat that they sank was actually Colombian, not Venezuelan.
I've heard that too.
And yeah. I haven't confirmed that, but that would be a whole different story because now you're attacking boats from two different countries.
Yeah.
So,
well, at least there would be like an actual drug claim if it was Colombian, because almost none of our drugs come from Venezuela. Now, there's not good information here. I tried to draw the raw data, but you can't find it. But there's lots of independent analysis about where certain drugs in the United States come from. So the question is, how much does the U.S. drug problem trace itself back to Venezuela? And there's a couple of different wrinkles to that, so that's why I framed the question that way. And obviously, keep this all with a grain of salt because there isn't good data here. Even the feds don't really release great data in this area. Well, one, what is the drug that we're most worried about?
Fentanyl.
Does any fentanyl come from Venezuela? Almost none.
My knowledge is the precursors come in from China into Mexico, and then they are trafficked over
and
the border.
India.
Yeah. If the case is anything, it's cocaine. But even most cocaine doesn't come from Venezuela. It comes from Colombia through Venezuela. So what are we doing in Venezuela?
It seems like you're painting the picture that there have to be ulterior motives here.
Yeah. I mean,
And is it just that Maduro is a socialist and they want to throw him out and put in a puppet, you know, leader that's compliant to the U.S.?
So let me give you the rest of the stats.
Sure.
7% is the total amount of potential drug trade from Venezuela. 7%. 80% of the fentanyl comes from Mexico. The rest of the percentage of total drug trade is almost all from Central America and Canada. So none of this makes any sense. From that point of view, right? From
start bombing Canada, dude. I think we just got to start bombing
and
Canada.
And I don't even think Canada is a big portion of that. It's just like, yeah, weed and stuff.
For sure.
And this is some, and it wasn't always clear to me, this is how bad the data is. It wasn't always clear to me what I was looking at is fresh data or older data or all that kind of stuff. So it's really unfortunate. And maybe I got
to
do more research.
Well, I mean, it's all designed to be clandestine. I mean, the only drugs that we would know about were ones that we were able to interdict in some way, right? Like, in transit.
Yeah. And if you blow it up, you don't know what your rate is. Exactly that, right? So therefore, is there another alternative motive? Yeah, of course there is. I mean, like, this feels very much like Gulf of Tonkin, Iraq war combination,
weapons
right?
of mass destruction.
Just putting people as tripwire, putting forces in tripwire places, and then generating intelligence. Like, if the entirety of the intelligence cases is the video of night vision of blowing up a boat, if that's the entirety of their evidentiary case, then it's clearly legal.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because there's no authorizing authority here. Unless you're appealing to like the UN charter on like self-defense. But even then, you still need like some evidentiary basis for it of like, this is why this was a threat to America.
Right. And why couldn't they just run a Coast Guard cutter out there or a Navy ship out there and board them and capture them and take the drugs?
Yeah.
No, and, the logical first step
and then
is
do the pose,
up.
You know, with the mountain of cocaine.
Yeah, or, right. You know? What was that, Bennett?
The logical first step is blow it up.
Yeah, right.
Kill everyone.
Just drugging all the fish of the Caribbean with cocaine. And we're going to have cocaine sharks.
Yeah, I was going to say that's going to be a movie. Cocaine Sharknado.
Cocaine Sharknado. Coming soon to a theater near you.
So So what is the alternative motive? Well, there's a couple. If you look at it like the public choice economics, right, is what are the actors at play and what did they benefit from it? What is Trump in of it? I don't really know if this is a Trump play. You know what I mean? Other than, you know, potential win for something that looks, quote, easy.
Yeah. I mean, the second obvious one is military-industrial complex win.
Mm-hmm. But you know, how sensitive he is to that, I think he's somewhat sensitive, but he hasn't been that guy, per se. Like, he's the whole MAGA first thing is kind of contrary to a lot of their shit.
True,
but Marco Rubio.
But America first hasn't really won out. Over the MIC with regard to Ukraine or Israel. I mean, Trump just signed more money away to Ukraine.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, but that could also be, there's good reasons for that too. And you could steel man that is what I mean.
Sure.
Like you could steel man it that because it took so long under Biden, there wasn't really any reason for Putin to pull out. And then he couldn't get Zelensky on board, so therefore to put pressure on Putin he had to double down the opposite direction, start saying, well, of course Ukraine can win, we just gotta give him more weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, that's maybe the only card he has to play there. I always kind of thought he was authentically trying to reset relations with Russia and actually wants to.
Yeah, seemed that way. He's a Russian puppet, obviously.
Yeah, right. But maybe not. Maybe he is more sensitive to that than I'm going it to. I don't know. So there's I would just rank that as probable but not likely.
Yeah.
So
Rubio then is your prime
Rubio,
suspect.
I mean, because the Florida context is so interesting,
yeah.
Right? You got the Cuban exile thing and you have the Venezuelan exile thing where it's a large part of the demographic. It's a large part of what has moved to the right in Latino politics is those two factions. And there's a legacy within the culture of DC around this going all the way back to the Standard Oil purchasing rights and then refusing to actually give it up. And I did a whole monologue on the back on the U.S. history between Venezuela and America on the geopolitics there that you should check out. Maybe we'll put in a button up here, Bennett, when we do that, you know, put the button there.
You're going to put the button in, Bennett? Bennett on the buttons?
We'll try to figure out how to do that.
Yeah, we pay him with high fives, guys. So yeah, we'll see if we can make it happen. I think, you know, between those two things, I think is the dominant explanation, right? Because on its own, what Venezuela's done is not that different from what most other countries have done, right? Canada or Mexico has its own oil company, mm-hmm. right? That was nationalized from prior investments from the West. We don't go do this there. We don't bomb Mexico because that's where all the fentanyl comes from. Why? Because they're one of the biggest trading partners of the U.S.
Where does Venezuelan oil go predominantly?
Well, it used to be sold all over the world. It used to be sold in the open market like everywhere else. And that's not that long ago. Like 2008, it was sold all over the world.
Right.
But with nationalizing it and everything else, it's now really just being sold against the actors that are most independent from the United States empire.
So the BRICS contingent, ostensibly.
Yeah, really, really. I mean, China, North Korea are their biggest consumers. And other, you know, African countries that we don't like so much.
So is this some sort of play to put pressure on China?
Definitely.
Through weakening their oil economy?
That could be an argument from Trump. Yeah. Yeah. For Trump. To be used on Trump to get him to support this sort of thing.
Interesting.
Definitely see that. Yeah. So, I mean, it could be China. Part of the China play. Yeah. That's a good thought.
Haven't heard that one in a while.
China.
One more time.
People from China, they love me.
Do they though? I'm not sure.
Don't trust China, China asshole. That's one of my favorite quotes from that election cycle.
So nothing bad can happen. Only
oh my god! Only,
what is it?
Nothing bad can happen. It can only good happen.
Totally forgot about that one.
God. Oh man,
so good.
So well, yeah, Venezuela developments there are interesting and worthy of watching. Now, the environment here is one where the cable news crowd is definitely on board with, like, well, drugs are bad, therefore this operation's good. But I really worry that people outside of the more nerdy, policy wonkish folks like me are only looking at this from a perspective of, like, keeping drugs out, not looking at this as, like, this is, like, very suspicious for what we're actually dealing with here when it comes to actually enforcing the drug trade. So there must be
don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious.
Exactly. Yeah, and it raises the question, why wouldn't you battle the drug war at your own border, which is now seemingly very well protected, mm-hmm. right? I mean, was reading that traffic is way slowed down and, like, it's very under control. Like, it would seem like that would be a better way to sort of stop it, maybe?
Yeah. It seems like the next,
too much of it?
The next pivot would be ports of entry and things like that.
Yeah.
That does slow down trade when you have to interdict everything that comes through the border to make sure there's not drugs in it. But, you know, a time doing that to undercut the cartels to make it punishingly hard, is that worth it? You know, there could be better drug policy too, right? Across the board, domestically within the United States, that you could address the drug problem so that fentanyl isn't such a problem.
I don't see how you do that right now, though.
No.
With the current national attitude, I don't think it plays.
Well, it's that, and it's just like, it is. As long as we have no ability functionally for local governments, or no ability, capacity now. For at one point, local governments were forbidden from stopping the open air drug scenes, right?
Right. So in Seattle, district court, San Francisco, whatever.
Yeah. The Martin case? Boise v. Martin.
Yeah.
You know, because of that, we couldn't do it. And if you're not tracking what happened a while ago, the reason why homelessness has exploded everywhere, amongst many other reasons, including COVID, including just jurisdictions being lazy, was a case that said if you can't kick someone out of urban camping unless you have beds that are filled and no empty beds in your area. So you owe the homeless people a bed if you're trying right. to kick them out.
And if your homeless shelter isn't open 7 days a week, then if you have to kick them out, basically they have to be able to live somewhere, meaning in a car or a camper or a tent on the street.
Right. Now that was the standard, and then it got overthrown recently, it was last year.
Yes.
Local governments have been slow to react, but some have. Even mm-hmm. Bozeman has now.
Yep. Missoula.
Other towns in Montana and probably your local jurisdiction. Some are reacting, some aren't. Some never really enforced the old one and just said, come at me, bro.
Yeah.
The remainder of there is that, you know, because of that open air drug scene.
Come at me, bro.
Yeah. We've had a tremendous pushback on any amount of drug softening on the drug war that has really been devastating. And what's really sad about that is that when you look at drug decriminalization and legalization across Europe, it was really done quite differently, where when they legalized or decriminalized, they stepped up enforcement of open air drug consumption. We did the exact opposite in like Oregon.
Right.
And it created disastrous outcomes, right? Because right. if you give someone, it's this indulgent, caring thing from their point of view to give someone access to drugs and then give someone access to all public spaces to use however they want, right. including shitting in the streets and shooting up heroin in front of your kids.
Right. It's enabling in the worst way.
Yeah. And that was a disastrous policy. And and should be absolutely condemned by everyone, including you libertarians, should be condemned because it's a public giveaway. It's a public indulgence to people to be able to use public spaces in ways that the public did not agree to.
Right. Right. Well, and you know, just sort of as another point to this whole idea of how do we combat the drug trade that's coming into the United States. Obviously, a lot of pressure is being put on right now with these ICE raids that are going on that, of course, we're going to talk about. But it seems like that's another interesting vector that we have a lot more direct control over that doesn't push us to the brink of potentially another hot war with another country mm-hmm. in a time when we're already spread very thin, we're already spending a ton of money, and the public is just so fatigued with the forever war bullshit that we've been putting up with since since 2001.
Yes, yes. I mean, like, and this is the delusion that's constantly there in D.C. It was like, well, it'll be easy. All we got to do, go in, overthrow Maduro. We already have the people selected that we're going to put in place, and we'll just do that, and it'll be no problem. Yeah.
And it's concerning, too, that it seems
it's
like...
It's worked every time.
Every time. Look yeah. Look at Maidan. It worked out so well.
So well.
It only brought us to the brink of nuclear war. You know? No big
yeah,
deal.
No yeah. big deal.
Right.
Well, at least Venezuela's not a nuclear power, though, right? It should be fine.
Sorry for interrupting.
No, you're fine.
No, it's good.
It seems concerning that, you know, this does seem to be the administration's posture, particularly with the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, kind of pushing this readiness mobilization narrative with, you know, like the new fitness standards and everything through the ranks, and like really kind of trying to fortify our military to seemingly be ready to go to war. I mean, even just the renaming of the Department of Defense to the Department of War is like, that kind of says something to me.
You know, I've always been two of minds about that. I always kind of felt like before it happened, a typical, you know, me, before it happened, I was like, you know, it is really dishonest to call it the Department of Defense for a long time now.
Well, yes.
You know? Especially, it was ironic that we switched it right before we became an empire, right?
And so
It seems even propaganda. More Orwellian, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
But now that it's happened, I'm more like, I kind of wish it was Department of Defense now. Because you're like, I want it to be defensive. That's always what I wanted it to be. I'd rather change the mission than change the name.
Yes.
We changed the wrong thing.
We did.
You know, like, and this is where a lot of these commitments actually really contradict the whole Trump agenda. Like, he's articulated repeatedly that what he wants is an American-focused foreign policy that benefits Americans. And I just don't see how this benefits Americans. Even if it undermines China, I don't think we need that in order to benefit Americans. You know what I mean? I mean, I really feel like the cost of this is not going to pay out in the dividends.
Yeah, I agree. I did hear him say something in passing, and I don't think there's been any policy movement on it yet, but something about reopening institutions, effectively, mental institutions for the homeless population that are, you know, drug-addled and crazy. Yeah. Like, we have to figure out something to do with that population. They can't just continue to live on the streets of every major city. It's just not a tenable situation.
Well, you need some degree of, I mean, I don't know what exactly it looks like. And I've struggled with this. I don't know what exactly it looks like, but I know it can't be what it is, right? What it is allowing people to be victimized on the street by criminals and by other homeless people and by the scenario that they've lost control over their own endocrinetic system, right?
Yeah.
At some point, you definitely want an entry that's as voluntary as you can up front. But then at some point, you need it to be involuntary. And where those lines are, we can discuss. And I think there's a completely reasonable place that we can come to via discussion on that point. As long as the case is that the left only wants it, oh, you can never, ever involuntarily commit somebody, I just don't know if you can get to the place where you have safe streets.
Right.
Or cities people want to live in.
Right.
Right. Which is a huge problem. Well, if you're a lefty, one of your huge problems is you want people to live in the city, right? Because there's tons of intensification that happens by that. It's much more efficient for many other reasons. And people traditionally, and I'm talking 10,000 years of history, show people want to live in cities close to other people.
Sure.
So, well, and that's not my shtick, but it's a lot of people's shtick. And so as long as you let this persist, your cities are going, the shitty walk, the cities will continue to degrade from the inside out.
Yeah.
And that is bad for our economy. It's bad for the people who live in those cities, and it's going to make them empty out and go out into the suburbs.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder to what degree the reinstitutionalization movement that Trump might be going towards is a workaround for all the Soros DAs that aren't prosecuting crime in these cities that are committed by drug abusers and criminals and things who are living on the streets, right? Because if you can't institutionalize them in jail for committing a crime that they should be imprisoned for, how can you get around that by saying this person is mentally unstable? Clearly, they're not well adjusted. They're not going to be a productive member of society. They've committed, 14 felonies and been released every time. Mm-hmm. This is our way to get them off the streets without having to use this corrupt, justice system that would take probably a very, very long time to repair.
Right. I mean, so if that is paired with treatment, like involuntary treatment.
Absolutely.
It seems like to me it comports with the center left's vision, right? I mean, the idea here is that if you get to a certain place in addiction, you can't stop and you need someone to help you stop.
Yeah.
Maybe even against your conscious will. There's a conservative sensibility in there that sometimes people don't want to be helped. and you got to help them against their will, or they're going to be destructive of everyone else around them. And we had to protect the community from those people.
I'm not saying
we need to put them in right into prisons right next door to rapists and murderers and thieves if they've done no wrong other than just gotten hooked on drugs.
Ideally not.
But urban camping is a crime. It should be a crime, and it has always been a crime in my mind.
Right.
Right? Because what it is theft. You're thieving from the general public space. It isn't yours to camp on. That's everybody's. You can't use it that way.
Right.
That's how we treat our national parks. That's how we should treat our city parks.
Yeah.
So why do we have this crazy policy? Well, it's because we just don't know what the heck to do with them. So we're just going to let them languish like this? That's also not compassion. There's a conservative compassion in the your better self, your better angel would not allow this to happen. So right. I will step in for you.
Right. Explain, because I think this is a useful mental model for this. We've maybe talked about it before, but the idea of you're stepping off the curb and a bus is going to hit you.
Mm. There's an implicit contract.
And I reach in and I pull you back from that bus hitting you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The whole concept
around
that is,
how dare you?
I am doing something to you that's against your will, but it is to keep you from dying. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's an implicit contract that you think, you know, the idea is that you would not want to die voluntarily. And so by me doing that action against your will to you, I'm actually doing you a service.
Yes,
sort of a similar thing.
Exactly. And that's like a libertarian framework. And if you kind of go that within the larger Western tradition, almost everything we operate on is on implicit contracts, implicit agreements to behave certain ways, meaning we get in line by the first person who arrives, not by the biggest, strongest guy who arrives in line. That's not true in every country in the world.
Right.
Right. The other like implicit ones about like, if I break something I'm looking at while I'm in your store, you know, it isn't that I have to sign a contract that if I break it, you buy it. It's the agreement when I walk in the building.
Right.
Right. Those sorts of things are all norms and values that arise bottom up in the social order that we get from a very specific Western tradition.
Yes.
Right. And so it's like a, what would be the word? I've always struggled what to call it, but it's like a Western chauvinistic libertarianism, right? Where it's like these ideas distill themselves into embedded values that we're trying to conserve, right? That those values that make society civil, peaceful, and run well. When we violate those by allowing people to steal from the public by camping out in the street, not only does it damage us in all these untenable ways, but it also undermines those value structures. We're like, well, fuck, if I'm doing my job and I'm doing everything and I'm paying my taxes and this guy, you know, gets to just live in the street and get free food all day, what am I doing all this work for?
Right, right.
You know, and for a certain set of people, that's like a compelling argument.
Yeah, it undermines.
We met one.
Yeah.
We met one here in Bozeman.
We did.
You know, we interviewed him.
Yep.
You know, it's like, why would I go pay $2,000 to rent a place where I have to have a roommate when I can just get in my camper and sit in the street?
Park on the street.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That person had a job.
He did.
You know, but it's a tremendous free rider problem that cannot persist if you're going to have a civilized society.
Right.
So we got to do something for it.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so that all those solutions, I think would pay bigger dividends than a regime change war in Venezuela. That's my case.
100%.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I'd rather spend the money there.
How dare you?
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly.
So we'll just get Lockheed Martin into building, And
mental institutions?
Yeah. Just have them build the mental institutions.
That's great. Yeah. Raytheon, you know, put in a bid. I'm sure it'll be high, but, you know, we'll make it happen.
All right. Yeah. So let's end it here, man. That was a great time. Yeah.
All right. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. It's been Human Reaction. On behalf of David Rand and Bennett, I'm Joe Sheehan. We'll see you in the next one.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
nothing bad can happen. It can only good happen.